Welcome to We Are Liverpool. It's Liverpool Football Club's official podcast where Robbie Fowler and myself, Peter McDowell, talk to current and former players about their lives on and off the pitch. Some good and bad news for you today. The bad news is that this is the final episode of our first series. We really hope you've enjoyed it. And remember, wherever you get your podcasts, you can catch up on all episodes you may have missed. And you can watch them too on our official YouTube channel. The good news is that we're rounding this series off with one of the most talented players in generations. He talks a brilliant game too. Jan Molby joins us for episode 10. And here's a taste of what to expect.
What a dream start to a professional football career that you run into somebody like Johan Cruyff. The first 6 weeks at Ajax was murder. It's the only time really in my career where I've doubted my ability. I broke a metatarsal. Ronnie Moran goes, go and put that under the tap, son. They'd obviously got themselves down the tunnel and ended up in the dressing room and ended up in the bath, you know, where we should have been, isn't it? Fans of other football clubs always go, you always go over at Anfield, and I go, yeah, but it's special. Anfield was a place of comfort because of the people.
Before we get into the episode, just a short message to tell you about our LFC Store app. It's available to download on Apple and Android now and gives users lots of exclusive discounts and offers on official products. Right now, here's what happened when Jan joined us.
So Jan, great to have you on. You are football and royalty in my eyes, man. And we always start the the chat with what does Liverpool mean to you? So what is your Liverpool?
So when I came, I had no expectations of the football club or the city. So the one thing, and I still experience this to this very day, is the most welcoming place on earth. And even when I speak to people today who've never been here before, they say the same. It's the most welcoming place on earth. It doesn't matter where you go. You get the feeling that people are on your side. And I think coming over in 1984 from mainland Europe has been one of the first ones, and certainly being the first one at Liverpool, isn't it? What you really need. Because it's one thing being on the mainland, it's an island in itself, isn't it? I was playing in the Netherlands, but it felt like I was almost still at home, isn't it? But now you're going to the UK, you know, you're on an island. So you needed to feel that people was on your side. And I felt that from day one. I mean, didn't get off to the start I'd hoped for in terms of playing. But the city welcomed me. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, here we are 39 years later, I'm still here.
You know, when you were growing up, and obviously you've come through all the, you know, the academy football teams in Denmark, you've gone on to Holland. Did you have a real know-how of Liverpool as not as a city but as a football club?
I obviously went through what everybody else went through in the 70s, the Shoot and the Match magazines.
I mean, was televisions out in Denmark?
No, but they are now. we just brought them out along with electricity. So in the 70s, in the winter months, we would get a 3 o'clock Saturday kickoff once a week. So I had a fair bit of knowledge, but of course the real excitement was always the European Cups. Those Wednesday nights, because in those days everybody played European football on a Wednesday night, and you get a chance to stay up and watch that. And obviously Liverpool were very successful in that era. And I think there's also something striking about Liverpool, as it is with Real Madrid, and some Ajax, something to do with the kit, isn't it? You know, you kind of look at the kit and you go, yeah, that just looks right, doesn't it? You know, it's very traditional and whatever. So, yeah, I knew a fair bit about Liverpool. I don't know anywhere near the amount of information that players who can come to Liverpool these days in terms of on the internet, and you can go on YouTube and you can almost get the feeling that you've been at Anfield, but I've ever been there, isn't it? You know what I mean? So I had a fair idea of what to expect, and having said all of that, it still surprised me.
Take us back then, Jan, because you'd made your name as a teenager back home, and then Ajax becomes a possibility. How big a culture shock was that?
Well, obviously the biggest culture shock was going from part-time football in Denmark, training Tuesday and Thursdays, and then to becoming a full-time professional. And it's the only time really in my career where I've doubted my ability. The first 6 weeks at Ajax, where we trained three times a day and played a game every night, was murder, and I couldn't play. I was tired, but tiredness had never stopped me from being able to play in the past. But it did for those 6 weeks at Ajax, and I could even sense the coach. And I do believe that the coach was the one pushing for Ajax to sign me. He was getting a bit worried, you know. And then overnight, you just get all the energy back. And it just changed. We played in that world-famous Amsterdam tournament that was every year in August. We played against Spurs in a game. We were 2-0 down, 1-3. I didn't score, but that was the one game where you went, okay, yeah, I can also handle this level. But for the first 6 weeks, it was difficult. And, of course, then the second thing is going from a relatively small place in Denmark to what is a major city, Amsterdam. There's something going on all the time, isn't it? But we lived outside of the city. We didn't get too involved. Amsterdam was a city that lived its own life, isn't it? And we were famous, but we never quite got the worship that you certainly get in a city like Liverpool. Mm.
When you went from obviously Denmark to Amsterdam, did you go with your family or was you, no. was it you and part of a group of young players?
Well, yeah, I was part of a younger group of players, but there was also another couple of Danes, and that was probably the sort of wee thing. Jesper Olsen, you remember, yeah. went to Manchester United, another guy called Søren Lerby. Yeah. And apart from that, the other sort of group of young players was like Marco van Basten, Frank Rijkaard, Ronald Koeman, and there was a few others. I was part of winning the European Championship in 1988, but I never really got close with any of them. It was sort of more of a professional relationship, yeah. really. And as I had no expectations of what to expect from a football club, I thought that was a norm. You come into work, you train in the morning, you have a bit of lunch, you play a bit of billiard, then you train again, then you go home. You'll have a bit of interaction with the players when we play away games and we stay in hotels and whatever. But beyond that, social life, golfing or whatever it was, squad days out, we didn't do any of those.
You spoke there about how tough it was. Are you talking physically then, the demands on you every day to train? Can you give us a bit more detail about what that might look like, an average day in training at
Yeah,
Ajax?
So I mean, you know, when I joined Ajax, I joined them on a Thursday, and on a Saturday morning, we went away to a training camp where we would get woken every morning at 10 to 7, get your kids on court for 7:15, then we go out for the run. That run was two-faced. It was obviously for your fitness, but it was also technical running. It was always a big thing with Ajax where they almost retrain you in how to run, how to get the maximum out of you. The guy who was in charge of the Dutch Olympic team was our running coach. We would then come back to the hotel, have some breakfast, and we'd then train at 10:30, come back, have some lunch, and we would then do specific training sessions in the afternoon, which for some people could be weights, for others it could be sprinting. And then we play a game every night at 7 o'clock. The majority of the demands on us at Ajax wasn't training, because Ajax is a developing club. They bring you in, the idea is to develop you, make you a better player, and then make a profit on the sale. Of course, results are important, but and although we only won the Dutch Championship in one of the 2 years I was there, it was more about personal development, and you know, whether that was Jesper Olsen going to Manchester United or me going to Liverpool. And then you had the other boys, AC Milan with Marco yeah. van Basten and Frank Rijkaard and all the boys in it. So that was very, very important. It was a clear message from Ajax is that, yeah, of course we play games. You know, we play 34 league games a year and we play everything else in it, but training plays a massive part in what we do here. I generally didn't think I would crack this. You know, I thought, well, okay. Yeah, I have a 3-year contract and we'll see in it, but I generally didn't think I'd crack it. So when I cracked it, and it was the week before the season started, and then the season starts, and yeah, it was a relatively comfortable start in terms of the teams that we played against, but after 4 games, I scored 3 goals and I was top scorer in the Eredivisie, Robert. Have you ever experienced that?
not in our league, no.
Exactly,
no.
Exactly, yeah. So because of that, the paper did an interview with me, and then you kind of go, you know, It's another step, isn't it? Because now all of a sudden there's a big article in one of the papers and everybody knows who you are, isn't it?
Yeah. So was that a big fear then, that you're going to have to go home with your tail between your legs? And
I don't think it was a big fear, because, again, I didn't have any expectations. I didn't go to Ajax and think, what's going to come off this? Yeah. I didn't go to Ajax and think they're going to turn me into an even better player and I'm going to go and play for A, B and C. I just went there and took it for what it was, and that was a 3-year contract at Ajax. We'd seen a lot of Danish footballers in the late 70s and early 80s who'd gone out and then come back home. It was never a big deal. So I never viewed it as a big deal. I was quite prepared to do it, and the reason being Ajax. Of course, Johan Cruyff was also there, which was a big pull, isn't it? So had I gone home after a year, 2 or 3, I don't think I would have looked back and gone, I failed. I would have gone, I took it for what it was. It was great, isn't it? But I think then, once you sort of almost crack professional football, then you want more, don't you? And then you realise, okay, this is going to be it for the duration of my playing career. Now I want to play outside of Denmark, and I want to be at the highest level I can.
Your relationship with Johan Cruyff is something that comes across very clearly, your admiration for him. He obviously thought you were a great player as well. What was that relationship like day to day?
It's difficult when you get somebody as big as him. You know, we also have it at Liverpool that there's obviously players, current players or former players who are bigger than others. Johan Cruyff is royalty of that, there's no doubt, isn't it? And it was almost as if he didn't fit in with all of us because he was simply too big. But he was a great student of the game. You could never accuse him of not being involved. He was always present. He was never absent in that. When he was involved, whether it was training or matches, he was 100% wanted to do well and wanted to affect everybody around him, as he did with a lot of young players, but I think especially with young foreign players. He took a lot of interest in us, and he talked to us a lot about the game and the way that he thinks the game should be played, and you know, things that, and you won't like this, Robbie, but he was always on about left-footed penalty takers. You know, I mean, they shouldn't take penalties. And he had all these ideas, isn't it? So I played with him for 1 year, and then he moved to final and played against him then in the second year. And then you have no contact with somebody as big as Johan Cruyff until 1990, when he was to go to Barcelona, and he wanted to sign me for Barcelona, which that was the big surprise, because I'm thinking that Cruyff won't even remember having played with him, but obviously he did. And I think what he liked was the versatility in that I could play sweeper while Ronald Koeman was out injured, and then once he became fit, I could go and play in midfield. And I always think, and the guy I spoke to at Barcelona said that, he said, Cruyff likes your tactical understanding of the game, which was obviously a massive part at Ajax, because of almost like a total football they were playing in those days, isn't it? You know, whereas Liverpool, it was maybe a little bit more rigid, but you still needed to be able to play.
How did that unfold then, him coming for you at Liverpool?
So 1990, he became the coach of Barcelona in 1989. They signed Ronald Koeman, and Ronald Koeman ruptured his Achilles Sunday night, and they contacted me on a Monday morning. Cruyff said to his assistant, draw me a list of players who can come and play A for Barcelona, B play sweeper libero when Koeman is out injured, and then when he returns, who can then slot into midfield. And the guy said, I stuck your name on the list. And Cruyff went, go and get Jan. And that's how it came about. So he said, do you want to come to Barcelona? I said, that's got absolutely nothing to do with me. I said, you contact the club and see if Liverpool are prepared to sell me. I don't know whether they were prepared to sell me or not, but in the end, they agreed on a 1.6 million fee. But in the end, when Liverpool pressed the buttons and said to Barcelona, you need to pay 1.6 million up front because we need to replace Jan, they offered him 400,000 over the 4 years, and Liverpool said no. Spoke to Peter Robbins, spoke to Kenny Dalglish, and even Johan rung me up, and he said, I knew we had no money. He said, but I thought they would have bent over backwards for Johan Cruyff. They didn't. They told Johan that he had to promote from within the B team. And in November 1990, Pep Guardiola made his debut for Barcelona.
It's your fault, isn't it?
You to blame.
Yeah.
Man City's dominant now.
It's my fault that he, well, maybe so, Rob. I can live with that.
You say you can live with it. Is there any regret that you never got the chance to play there?
No, none whatsoever. It wasn't Barcelona. It was Johan Cruyff that was of interest. And also Michael Laudrup was there as a player, which I quite liked that idea. But I look back on my career and, the second 6 years at Liverpool from 1996 wasn't quite as successful personally and for the team as the first 6 years. But I ended up being at Liverpool for 12 years and it gave me a base. I'm absolutely 100% convinced that had I gone to Barcelona, I wouldn't have stayed at Barcelona for 4 years. I'd have probably ended up having 6 years at Liverpool, 2 years at Barcelona, 2 years somewhere else, and today I would have been living back home in Denmark. Instead of that, I ended up with a 12-year career at Liverpool, being massively part of, obviously, the time I was there, but also time after football, you know. So, no, it sits well with me, and it sits well with me as well because, as a family, we're a very loyal family. You know, my brothers and sisters and whatever, they all had the same jobs, you know, I mean, we're very loyal, and I think that proves that with 12 years at Liverpool, you know, I would have hated sort of a career of a little bit here and a little bit of there, isn't it? So I look back and I go, I think it's a great story, the Johan Cruyff and the Barcelona story, but regrets, none whatsoever.
Mm. Yeah, and can you, and you just mentioned there about obviously Johan Cruyff there, we know what he's like as a player, can you give us a little bit of an insight to what his football and tactic would be, or...
It's a bit like Pep Guardiola, Robbie. They see things that nobody else sees. They explain things to you, you know, about the way that they think that the game should be played. Johan Cruyff tells a story about, it's a bit like the same we do at Liverpool. Pre-season, you have a game, first team against reserves. But at Liverpool, you mix the teams up maybe a little bit. But at Ajax, it was first team against reserves because the reserves weren't full-time professionals. And the reserves were turning over to be all like 16, 17, 18 year old young kids, the next group of young players. And it'd be a really tough game. And Cruyff said, the reserve team was short, so they introduced Cruyff at 15 to play in this game against Ajax, who were the best team in Europe at the time. And he said, they asked me to play in the game. And then they said, Yobi, it was like his nickname, Yobi, you're going to play centre midfield. And he went, I knew then, he said, centre midfield, I can just control the game. And the kid man, who was there for 100 years, he went, that's a true story now. He said, we came in the dressing room after the first team and went, who's this kid, you know? Brilliant. He said, and that was his... His big strength was, as well as being able to play football at this level, the control of the game that he had. You know, he was always pointing and pushing and run this way. And, you know, he was just a remarkable man. But he just saw things that nobody else saw. And he would explain things to you and you'd go, wow, you know. And most of the things he wouldn't do. We felt a little bit because we were 18, 19, 20 and we were just starting out. And we felt a little bit... Maybe he knows a little bit too much, isn't he? You know, yeah. He could be annoying sometimes, isn't it? But I look back and I go, what a dream starts a professional football career that you run into somebody like Johan Cruyff. And if you need anyone to back up what I say, sit down with Pep Guardiola. You would need a 25-hour podcast for him to tell you the admiration that he had for Johan Cruyff and Johan Cruyff's ideas.
Did you ever have that as a player? He was talking about Cruyff's impression of 15, where you saw a player you'd never seen before and you just went, wow, where's this kid come from?
I think you have seen it in players. I think certainly from a Liverpool point of view, you look at Stevie G, for example, he steps up and you look at a player and he'll come into the realms of a first team environment and wouldn't look out of place. I mean, Michael Owen done it, Stevie G done it. You know, players who come in and you think, wow, these are... And without being a little bit stupid here, you can see players, obviously, the temperaments of how they control themselves on a pitch, how they run. It sounds a bit stupid, but you...
No. But you do. You
know, how they run, how they control the ball, how they pass the ball.
Even, Robbie, even sometimes how they walk.
Yeah.
You know, you go, well, you go, he's got a chance in. You know,
and what's someone walking on pitch?
Honest to God, I'm telling you now, it's just things that looks right.
Yeah.
There's also the exception, isn't there? But a lot of things, it is a basic of the way that you behave, isn't it?
To carry yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you've said that, because I've thought about that for years, you know, about the
it's
way
you run.
It's
a very difficult thing to explain, isn't it? You know, I mean, people go, you're really sure, isn't it? But sometimes you look and you go, he looks a player, you know. And
so if someone ran onto a training pitch, you go, no.
Yeah, sometimes you would, yeah. Sometimes you would, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, you got players who's not... Like, it's like a control thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you're the control of your body and whatever, and you need that in football, don't you? And then sometimes you see somebody running across and you go, wow.
Genuinely, this is my favourite podcast already, because I totally agree with that. Yeah. And I've been sprouting that for years, and I don't think anyone's ever listened to me.
It does sound silly, but when you talk about the old boys at Liverpool, especially Bob Paisley, and the way that he buy it, but the way that the player walks or whatever, and can go, there's something not right about him and whatever, you know. So it is possible.
Do you know the other thing that's quite unbelievable about your story is you come from Ajax to Liverpool on trial. That wouldn't happen now, would it? As a player,
I guess there's still football players who go on trial, but I don't think there's many football players who are just turned 21. And I've been at Ajax for 2 years, and in all competitions, I think he played about 70 games, and I was a full international. I don't think many of those players would go on trial today. But the problem was, obviously, Graham Souness had left Liverpool unexpectedly, and they needed somebody. And whereas they would normally prepare for the departure of the next player, they hadn't. And I don't think they could find anyone. The message was pretty clear that if you want to have a chance to join Liverpool, you have to go on trial. They hadn't scouted me. And why would they? Very unusual anyway to go to mainland Europe. And they weren't looking for the type, because they had Graham Souness, isn't it? So I fully understood all that. You know, it was explained to me that, listen, they've never seen you play. They haven't scouted you. So this is kind of an opportunity, which very rarely comes along at Liverpool, isn't it? You know what I mean? Very rarely do Liverpool go, well, he's gone, what do we do now? If you look at, like, Ian Rush departing, yeah? But he was replaced before he left, because John Aldridge came in just before he left, isn't it? So they were ahead of the curve in terms of that, isn't it? Whereas, but soon as they were behind the curve. So they invited me off for 10 days. And the reason I agreed to it was, A, the chance to join Liverpool, but also I thought that I would be able to settle pretty quick and be able to show what I could do. And whether that was good enough or not, that was out of my hands. But I felt that I could settle because I'm not a nervous person as such. I don't think even in that company I would be nervous, and I'd be able to do what I can do. Sometimes, and when I was a manager, I've had players on trial, and unfortunately you have to tell them, no, we're not going to keep you. And they'd always go, well, I didn't show, you know, I wasn't at my best and I was a bit this and that. I never felt that that would be the case. I felt that if Liverpool didn't take me, it was because he didn't feel I was good enough, isn't it? I don't look back at the 10 days I was in trial and go, I wasn't myself. I think I was. I did what I do. And in the end, it was enough.
Was there any possibility of you joining any other clubs?
Yeah. I spoke to three clubs. Crystal Palace, Alan Mullery. Manchester City, Billy McNeil. And Sheffield Wednesday, Howard Wilkinson. Alan Mullery at Crystal Palace was a friend of the coach I had when I was in Denmark. And he was a big fan of me. And he said, when it became public knowledge that I was leaving Ajax, he said, you've got to have a look at this kid. Billy McNeil had been the manager of Celtic, and we played Celtic in the European Cup with Ajax, and Howard Wilkinson had seen me play for Denmark under 21s because that was at the level, and he was watching. So there was like a link to the clubs who came back and said were interested because the managers had actually seen me play, whereas certainly Joe Fagan at Liverpool had never ever seen me play. But came in, did the 10 days. As you know, Robert, the training is pretty relaxed at Liverpool, isn't it?
Certainly compared to what you were used to.
It was, yeah. But the emphasis and the pressure was on your matches, wasn't it?
So how far into the 10 days did you get an indication it was going to be all right?
I didn't. Trained, went to Wembley, played in the Community Shield. Jarvis Shield in those days, I didn't play. And then straight away after the game, we flew to Ireland. We had a game on a Monday in Ireland. One experience I remember, we went to the airport on a Saturday night. And because I was a trialist, and there is a little bit of a standoff sort with the players, isn't it? And I was just walking around the airport on my own. And all the lads were sitting in the bar. And they just shouted at me, come up here, you know. And I came up and they went, here you are. And it was a pint of Guinness. Because we were going to Ireland, isn't it? You know, it's like preparing yourself, you know, it's like altitude training, isn't it? You know, we're going to Ireland, let's have a Guinness, you know. And I took one taste and I went, I've never tasted it since, I didn't like it. But on a Monday night, we're playing Home Farm and it was my big game, wasn't it? So Saturday night when we get there, all the lads are going out. Sunday they're having a few beers and I'm thinking, I'm going to play here for my life on a Monday night, you know. So we played on a Monday night. After the game, we had a testimonial dinner for Phil Neal. And then we landed back at Manchester Airport Tuesday morning. And I said to Ronnie Moran, we're now at the airport. I'll just grab a flight back to Amsterdam, you know. And he went, no. He said, they want to see you at Anfield tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
And that was it? You went and did it?
So I went and did it like you do in those days. Jan, we've agreed a fee with Ajax. There's your contract, sign it. They'd already filled in the numbers and whatever. And you always felt that you were where you needed to be in terms of the wages. Signed a contract. Peter Robbins shook my hands and he went, good luck. And on we went.
Who were you close to then, though? Because you talked about the cultural differences then going to Ajax. Coming to Liverpool is a cultural difference football-wise and how you train. But, you know, the lads were of a, you know, an acquired taste as well, weren't they? Who did you get close to? Who were the friends that you had in the opening months?
What obviously helped was that there was three of us staying at the hotel when I joined. Paul Waltz and John Walk. And then eventually Kevin McDonald also joined and he stayed at the hotel. So I got pretty close to them. And of those, I got on the best with John Walk. I really liked John. He was a really good player. And I also felt that, I don't want to sound like too soft, isn't it? But you come into the group and there's an expectation that now you're here, you're part of the group, get on with it. I think John had a little bit of understanding for moving across from mainland Europe and all the challenges that you have, isn't it? So I really got on well with him, but pretty quick. I mean, when I played the game in Ireland, shared a room with Kenny Dalglish, which possibly employed by the club, wasn't it? I think about that time they decided that they were going to try and sign me and see what Kenny can do in terms of that. When we went to Wembley for the Community Shield, Charity Shield, I had a room on my own, which felt a bit, you know, oh, he's the trialist, he's on his own. Mm. The one story I remember from there, we had to wear a shirt and tie for the game. I didn't have a shirt and tie, so I bought a shirt and tie in Liverpool on a Thursday. But then I couldn't do the tie, so I had to knock on next door. And it was one of the youngsters who'd come down for the experience, since half, called Mark Seagraves.
Yeah.
And Big Siggy had to do my tie. So. But then, pretty quick, I became really close with Ian Rush. We sort of enjoyed the same things, same humour, both relatively young.
Would he have been able to do your tie, do you think, Rushy?
Yeah, I think he would have been able to do that, yeah. Because I think Rushy would have been, you know, at an early age, at school ties and whatever else you need to do. We don't have all them things, neither in Denmark or the Netherlands.
I often wonder about players who joined Liverpool during that spell from kind of, you know, the late 70s right the way through to the era you're talking about. You were coming into teams that were expected to win it all. You know, the first full season you play and it culminates in a European Cup final.
Yeah, but it also culminates in no trophies, which was very unusual. But when you look back and you think we finished second in the league, we lost in the FA Cup semi-final after a replay against Manchester United, and then we had the European Cup final. It's still very close, isn't it? But obviously it wasn't close enough. But You never felt that there was any pressure, and nobody ever viewed it as a disaster. Nobody ever viewed it as, now we need a clear out and we need a new team. People just felt that we just came up a little bit short.
If you had that season now, obviously with social media, there'd be a massive outcry.
Absolutely. I don't know whether they'd go as far as to call it bottling it, you know what I mean? But there would certainly be an inquest into, you know, a team who'd done what they did the year before, which also adds pressure, which was the treble. Yeah. You know, in 1984, which all these things add pressure, doesn't it? So, yeah, today there would have been an inquest. But you never felt in those days that there was an inquest in many of things. There was more of an understanding in that. And that also came from within the backroom staff that, we'll be all right, this team will go again next year.
You did go again, but obviously Heysel happened. There's a change with the manager as well. I mean, it was a fairly historic change, wasn't it, then?
Incredible. Incredible to think that. I know it was like the done thing in those days to have player managers, isn't it? But surely not for Liverpool, you know? Liverpool can't have a 35-year-old player manager, but we did.
What did you expect to happen then? Once you found out Joe was going, what were the lads talking about? This is the most likely thing to happen now, because it wasn't Kenny, was it? That wasn't the most likely change.
I don't think Kenny was ever mentioned because of the way that Kenny was, and that's not said in a negative way. But you never looked at Kenny and thinking, here's a guy that's ready to combine the two of them. It was more of a feeling that possibly it was going to be Phil Neal. But the club, like they often did in their own way, came to the conclusion that Kenny would be the better choice.
Was that always the case? Did you always think it was going to be in-house, or did you hear of any outside influences coming in? Or
nobody was ever mentioned from outside, Robbie. You always felt that it was either going to be Ronnie Moran. Well, it was probably going to be Ronnie Moran, because nobody thought in terms of player-manager, although I contradict myself a little bit when I say about Phil Neal, but that I think that was because so many people went, but Ronnie doesn't want to do it. You know, Ronnie never ever gave the impression that he wanted to be a manager. Mm. And then you think, well, what can we do? Because it has to be from within.
What changed then? What was the thing you put your finger on? Because you go on to have an incredible season, both individually and
the first thing that changes is the team, isn't it? When you look at what Kenny does, continue with Bruce, Hansen and Lawrenson, but Steve Nicol then became the right back in place of Phil Neal. Jim Beglin became the left back, permanent left back instead of Alan Kennedy. When you look at centre midfield, that became Steve McMahon and myself. Craig Johnson was reintroduced on the right. And then, of course, Paul Walsh replaced Kenny up front. So that's a lot of changes, isn't it? And it took a little bit of time before we settled. And it's not because of that sort of famous Manchester United goal that I managed to score. But I think that was the announcement of that team, was beating Manchester United at Anfield. They'd had an unbelievable start to the season. Mm. I think they won the first 10 league games of the season, and they came to Anfield and we beat them 2-1. I think that was like that night that team announced itself that, yes, we made a lot of changes, but we're ready to go. And then we just grew and grew and grew to the end of the season.
You had that settled team. Did that help you? Because you just knew what was happening. You knew that despite performances, if you were getting the right results, you were always going to play anyway.
Yeah, and that was massive. You wouldn't be able to do it today. But in those days, it fitted well. So obviously the first challenge you overcome is that you feel you got the right characters in the building. And you also feel that you got the right players. It's just a question of how long you can continue to be the right player in terms of the levels that you can keep at, isn't it? So all those things helped, isn't it? Today, because of how aggressive clubs are, once we will see again in the summer, clubs that have fallen short this season be unbelievably aggressive in the market, isn't it? That never really happened in our day, did it? You know, football clubs didn't tend to make as many changes as they do today in today's football. So you can get away with carrying the same squads. And if you look at all them players, Robert, that I played with in the 80s, how many of them was at Liverpool for 10 plus years? Yeah. It was quite incredible, isn't it? But hats off to how that all worked in those days. And obviously motivation is always a massive thing in it. But they managed to keep motivating us, so we kept delivering.
Just a quick break to remind you about the LFC Store app. It's the best place to hear about new LFC gear and store offers. You'll also be able to get access to exclusive offers and discounts too. Download it today on Android or Apple, and you can find more details on liverpoolfc.com/store. Now, let's get back to the show.
You're obviously not playing in Europe now. You're obviously still going to be winning leagues. The FA Cups was brilliant, but did that have a little bit of an effect on how you played certain games? Because obviously you weren't playing the Champions League, but the FA Cup was suddenly big again.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the history of Liverpool Football Club, from early 70s to 1985, there was a dominance of European football. And then obviously in 85, you get the European ban, and then you look at the involvement in the FA Cup all of a sudden. Mm. 86, 88, 89, 92, four finals in a competition that Liverpool weren't really renowned for doing particularly well in. So yeah, of course. And you mentioned the European Cup. I like the European Cup, but I've always liked the FA Cup more. And that's going back to some of the experiences I had as a young boy watching FA Cup on TV. There's something about, you know, when you're a kid, you just look and you don't look for explanations, do you? You just look and you go, I like this.
Yeah.
And I used to look at it and think, I like all this. 100,000 people, you know, where can you play in front of 100,000 people? Biggest stadium in Denmark at that time was probably about 35,000. So where can you actually play in front of 100,000 people? Where can you actually play with all these traditional things of the royal family, whatever, being there and, you know, coming down and meeting you and singing of the national anthem or whatever else it is, and all those traditions, isn't it? So where is that possible? Well, it's only possible in the FA Cup final, isn't it? So
yeah. So
when I came in 85, we said before, we lost in the semi-finals, didn't quite get there. But then when we got there in 86, it was like, whereas today, if you get to a cup final or whatever, you will probably disencourage players from getting too involved. We got involved in everything because you go, this is the game. and there's going to be footage of this game for many a years, and I want to be part of everything, you know what I mean? So when the TV cameras are on the coach going down to Wembley on a Saturday, yeah, I'll do an interview, you know, you want it to be seen and heard, isn't it? Because this was like your big moment, wasn't it? So we got involved in everything in the city, you know, we did the poster, didn't we? We were Everton and Liverpool, we were together and all them things, and we didn't say no to anything because this is it, you know, we want to be part of this.
So many flashbacks there from being a kid, isn't there?
I've got it myself, and you were talking about getting involved in everything, and what you're saying is brilliant. Cup final songs as well. You'd have loved all that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. It was absolutely rubbish, but that didn't matter. You know, and all them things, as you will know also, and it's not because of the 1996 Wembley suit, but we used to get what you call Wembley suits, isn't it? When you play a Wembley, you get a suit, you know, and I'm convinced that for it all, including shoes and socks and whatever, it maybe cost 60 quid, isn't it? But that was not the point.
It's the ceremony, isn't it?
It's the ceremony, isn't it? Yeah. You know, of the guy coming into it. I mean, there's a tailor coming into our dressing room. You know what I mean? And then they deliver your suit and you take it down. And when you come down on the Saturday to go on the coach, we all look the same, isn't it?
That's just brilliant.
You know, and you never, ever wear that suit again. But it's a Wembley suit.
There's loads of people watching this now, youngsters who will never understand how big a day the FA Cup final was. From 9 o'clock in the morning, it'd be on the telly, you played in them. But, you know, from a fan's point of view, but it was the biggest day of the year.
But it was equally as big as a player, though, isn't it? Because we would get up in the morning in our rooms. What do you think the first thing we'd do? Put the TV on, you know. So we watched the build-up to the game that we were going to be playing in, you know. So you'd be in the room watching that. The excitement, and even when you get to Wembley, you know, going out and looking on the pitch, and, you know, you just... It was really, in a way, overwhelming.
And you played in that 1986 final, the game of your life. Is that your favourite game ever?
It's a favourite game because of the magnitude of it and the importance of it all.
And the result.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, and also fans kind of decide your moments.
Yeah.
Because you speak to fans and they go, that's your best game, that's your best goal and whatever, and that's where you take from it, isn't it? So... The 86 Cup final was it. Yeah, that was the pinnacle. And I'm glad, in a way, because it was one of the reasons I came to England, to try and play in an FA Cup final at Wembley, you know what I mean? And I was glad then that the first time of asking, it kind of worked out okay.
I always remember you saying about, you know, you're a goal behind and then that team talk at half-time is all about, you will get your moment.
Yeah, and that was very much what they said, isn't it? And you look around and it was always a big thing, is that you as a player, and you can beat 1-0 in the Cup final, and you... I think it's just most players do this, Robbie, isn't it? They go, we got a chance because I'm still in the game, yeah. But that's how we feel, isn't it? But then it also helps that you look, I'm wearing number 10, you look to your right and there's Ian Rush, and you go, yeah, McKennie's there, number 7, isn't it? And you go, Hanson and Lawrence at the back, it will be okay, you know. So we just have to wait for our moments, because we know that we can get to when we hopefully get our moment, whether that's 15 minutes, 30 minutes or whatever, we can get to there because... We've got the quality, isn't it? And then the funny thing about the moment is that you also know we got the quality when the moment comes. And when that moment comes and we make it 1-1, then instantly, and of course I could have been wrong in it, but instantly I thought we're going to win this. You know, that's your next sort of wave of emotions. You go, this is done now. I don't care what anyone says. This is what we do. We break them. So as much as you go, some unbelievable football teams in the 70s and 80s, we also broke them physically and mentally, you know what I mean? And that's what I felt. And it took less than 15 minutes and it was done and dusted.
Those iconic memories of the Wembley finals. Just think the Jans game in 86, where he's had the game of his life, about to go to a World Cup. He must be looking forward to getting in the big bath with all the lads and all the lagers at the end.
And the Scousers.
Tell everyone about that, because this is one of my favourite stories where your career is concerned.
With the four Liverpool fans who ended up in the dressing room. And I was telling that story years ago on a radio station, and one of the lads actually rung in because I could see the presenter thinking, what is this all about, Jan, you know what I mean? But they'd obviously got themselves down the tunnel and ended up in the dressing room and ended up in the bath, you know, where we should have been, isn't it?
Remarkable. Didn't Kenny see them as well? And he knew they were going to get arrested, so he ushered them out of the way.
They somehow found their way down to...
They were in full... clothes as well, suits.
Yeah. But in the cup final suit, didn't quite
get one of them, Robbie. No.
What was it about that team that made it so dominant then?
Yeah, that's a good question, really, because when you look at teams before and teams after, you'll probably have Liverpool players who had longer and better careers. I just think it was that determination that we sort of hung on. Got our way through the FA Cup early rounds. We got beat, knocked out in the semi-final of the League Cup, isn't it? And in the league, there was a feeling that Everton were probably the better team, but we hung in. And then the final stretch, Liverpool at their best. Let's go. And it's as if your mind almost narrows a bit, isn't it? Because now there is no room for errors. Now we have to do our stuff, isn't it? I can't be 100% sure, isn't it? But I always get the impression that there was no club better than doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody goes, okay, there's no more room now for errors. We got to go. And if you look at the finish of that season, the league finishes well documented, 12 games, 11 wins and a draw. But you stick on top of that, the FA Cup games as well, isn't it? So I think you end up with 17 games, 16 wins and a draw. In any era, that's impressive.
You know, the simplicity of all that as well. And it, I mean, it's fascinating that you're talking about the morale of the team as well. But you know what? You were good players.
It certainly helps having good players, doesn't
and,
it?
And this is what I think what we were talking about before. So your life into the Liverpool life, if you like, coming from Ajax, where, you know, everything's technically brilliant, where, you know, you... The training is far superior. Then you come to Liverpool and the simplicity of playing five-a-sides, and the ethos was all about on what we could do and what you could do as players, as opposed to worrying about the opposition.
I don't know how you felt about those five-a-sides, Robbie, but I always felt that they gave you everything that you needed.
Yeah.
It's basically on a smaller scale what you do on a Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it's all about angles and even the pressing and everything else that we did.
It's passing it the right way.
Yeah, yeah. So... I always felt it served a purpose, isn't it? I fully understand the other side of coaching as well. But they always felt at Liverpool is that we trust that you're a good player. Now we've got to make sure that we give you the platform you can show that you're a good player. And a big part of that was also the mental side, isn't it? You know, that you go again and you go again and you go again. And that's proven over those 25 years from 65 to 90, isn't it? The need to mentally be strong to go again and again and again, because that is what happened.
Yeah. If we were to mention Anfield... What would that mean to you?
So obviously there's two Anfields, isn't there? There's the Anfield that everybody sees on match days, and then there's the Anfield that mainly only we have the privilege of, isn't it?
Yeah.
And probably us more than players in later life, because we used to report to Anfield every day, you know, every morning. So Anfield becomes a second home, doesn't it? And the transformation from it being in the week to match days is quite remarkable, isn't it? It's a place of comfort, really. I mean, whatever way you talk about it, what we did was high pressure and very difficult, isn't it? So a place of comfort is very important, isn't it? And you always felt that Anfield was a place of comfort, isn't it? Because of the people, because of the history. I know fans of other football clubs always go, you always go about Anfield, and I go, yeah, but it's special. You know, I've been to so many football stadiums, and I've had other home stadiums in my career, isn't it? But never quite the same. It's filled with history. It's filled with comfort. So you always know that while you're there doing your job, you're in good hands and you're safe, you know, and people will support you. And I think that's massive, isn't it? You know, you can go out and play and you know you'll be okay, isn't it? You know, nobody's going to be screaming at you and people don't boo you, do they? And yeah, of course, there's disappointment like there is at every other stadium, isn't it? But I just feel it's a little bit different.
How do you look back on 87, 88? Because a lot of this modern Liverpool team that was so brilliant and flamboyant was compared with that time as well. But for you personally,
nightmare.
Off the pitch, it must have been a horrible year.
It was obviously a nightmare because I broke a metatarsal pre-season. And
was that before it was famous?
Yeah, it was before it was famous. So
I broke my foot.
Broke my foot, yeah. And I'll tell you a story. It's very typical Liverpool. Saturday morning, we have a game at Melwood's. John Walk, late for the tackle, stamps on my foot. Pain, unbelievable. Ronnie Moran goes, go and put that under the tap, son. So I go and run the tap in the coach's room onto the... I couldn't even... It was that sore. So I then go on the coach, back up to Anfield, and the main car park at Anfield was getting done, so we had to park on the other side in the Kemlin Road and walk around the stadium. I could hardly walk, so broken bone in my foot. And I go in for treatment. And obviously we've got no physio, have we? So they're having a look and they go, it doesn't look too bad, son, you know. No swelling, no bruising, no nothing. I said, but I can't walk. They said, tell you what, go to Walton Hospital. So I go back over my car. I can't change gears, can I? There's no automatic. I can't change gears. My left foot is killing me. So I get one of the stewards to drive me down to Walton Hospital. I give him a tenner for the taxi back. Go in, have an x-ray. broken bone, foot, whatever, in plaster 6 weeks. So I ring my mate, he comes in a taxi over, drive my car back to him. Then I ring Ronnie Moran on a Saturday. All right, son. I said, yeah, I broken my foot. I'm in plaster for 6 weeks. He goes, all right, son. He said, as you know, we're going on pre-season tour on Monday. We'll see you when we come back.
So that was it.
They go to Munich with the new team, don't they? And then after Munich, Kenny rung me and he went, what are you up to? I said, I'm just sitting at home bored. I can't do anything, you know what I mean? I'm on crutches and I live on my own and whatever. He said, get yourself on a plane. He said, we're going to Scandinavia, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, and come out here. And it was the longest pre-season tour in history. It was like 23 days, and I was out there with the team. And then we're sitting there one night. I think the lads had gone to bed. I'm sitting having a drink with the coaches and Kenny, and Kenny looks at him and he goes, you've had a great time, haven't you? I said, yeah, it's been really good. He said, when you get back, he said, you're going to Lillishaw, which was the place that you would use for the rehab of players in those days. So I went, when I came back on a Monday, I went to Lillishaw in plaster and everything just to get me working again. I said, but yeah. So that was a nightmare. I then came back and played, and I played a reserve game at Everton and got injured again. And I never really returned again till April. And there was no way back into the team, because we'd signed John Barnes and Ronnie had gone from playing on the left to playing in my position in the centre midfield with Steve McMahon. And then all there is the cup final in 88, where I was one or two substitutes with Craig Johnson, came on for 13 minutes. I just wish that Kenny would have put me on when he put Craig on and give me a bit more time. Because I always feel that what you needed against Wimbledon, who was defending deep en masse, was maybe something slightly different to what Craig brought, isn't it? But everything's easy in hindsight, isn't it?
Yeah, well, absolutely. You were arrested in the February as well.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Called reckless driving. People go, drink, I said, no, reckless driving. Never thought much of it. But obviously the consequences were horrendous. Ended up in jail for the period, which, to be honest, at that time I thought, well, that's it. You know, time at Liverpool's over. But the support from Sir John Smith, Peter Robinson and Kenny was unbelievable.
Talk us through that moment then where you realised that, you know, you at the top of your tree playing for Liverpool, you're going to end up going to jail.
So the court case on a Monday morning, it's not really a court case because I'm pleading guilty. And the solicitor goes, ban, that's okay, said, you can get a driver and a relatively heavy fine, but that's okay, said, you can afford that. So when you go into court thinking that's going to be the outcome, you can then imagine, can't you? When the judge goes, I'm sentencing you to 90 days in jail. And they take you there and then. Had that been in Denmark for a driving offence, they'd have probably given you a date to turn up at jail. Mm. But they took me there and then. I spent 2 days in Walton before I was moved to an open prison. But I'm in Walton and I'm in my cell on my own. Because to be fair, I guess most of the wardens were Liverpool fans and they did what they did to protect me. And they go, corner cell in there. But it was September, I think, and the weather was quite nice, so everybody had the windows open. But everybody's in their cells from 9 o'clock onwards. And then they start. All right, hey, Jan. You know, what's it like to play at Wembley? Before I could say anything, this fella goes, yeah, it was all right. So you had this Scouser being Jan Mulby for about an hour and a half, and people are firing questions out the window. So the next morning, I get up, and this kid is cleaning outside, and he went, did you enjoy that last night? I went, yeah, brilliant. He said, that was me, Dad. He said, that was good. So people asking him, what's your favourite goal? Well, you know, it's obviously not something you look back on with any kind of pride, you know.
Filling that time, though, you ended up making friends in there with somebody who was, you know, working in the gym every day and took you under his wing, didn't he? I can remember you coming out in unbelievable shape.
To be fair, the guy, in his own time, finished work and then come and got me and said, come on then. Because gone away with some gym work and playing a bit of five-a-side with loads of people, but it got a bit from time to time, and there was always somebody who wanted to have a pop. So this guy goes, listen, he said, you need to do some work. He said, so I'll come and get you. I finish at 4 o'clock every day. To be fair, he finished at 4 o'clock, came and took me to the gym, and we'd do sometimes 2 hours. Unbelievable, really kind. And we talked about football and blah, blah, whatever. And when I then, due to be released, I said, listen, I said, and I mean this, anything I can do, tickets to Anfield, anything. He said, yeah, he said, I wouldn't ever want to go and watch Liverpool at Anfield. He said, I'm a massive Manchester United fan, you know what I mean? He said, so I'd never ever want to do that. But yeah, that was terrific.
I'm always conscious when we're doing these shows that there will be younger people watching or listening. You two played together. What are your memories of each other?
I've said numerous times, so when I think of the great, great Liverpool players, you know, I've played with, I'd always put Jan there because of the type of player he was. I'm a striker. So I want players who can put the ball anywhere I want. And I love being, you know, in front of a player like that because I know that I was always going to get a chance as a striker. That's what you want. You need players like you, I think, in any team.
We obviously all remember Robbie. There'd be relatively few who'd come through from the youth team, and probably the most successful would be Gary Ablett. And then the next is that group of Robbie and Steve McManam or whatever. So you see Robbie, what we hear about his goals, whether that's in the reserves or the A team or whatever, and then we see him. And I always remember that youth tournament for England.
Yeah.
When was that, Robbie?
92. Yeah, yeah. 92.
And I remember watching that on TV, and you go, yeah, yeah. And then he came back, and I'm standing watching the reserve youth team train, and the manager soon as comes over behind me, and he goes, what do you think? I said, I don't think we've got any choice. You know, like I'm now backroom staff. Yeah. I don't think we've got any choice. I said, stick him in. He said, he's a bit fragile, isn't he? I said, yeah. I said, but I don't think that's a negative. I said, because you're only fragile if you need to have contact, isn't he? If you make it a physical game. Robbie doesn't make it a physical game. You know, he makes it a game about space.
Yeah.
I said, so go on. He goes, okay, we're going to do it. And the rest is history, you know. Fulham away, isn't it? Fulham away.
Yeah. I think I've got you to thank then, haven't I? Yeah,
and, hey? No, I think he'd made his mind up already.
Yeah.
But as you always want in those situations, it's just you look and you go, yeah. It's very difficult. It's a big call, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's a big call, and especially with the players that's at the club already, and he'd invested heavily in recruitment as well, isn't it? And then all of a sudden we're going to go back to a U team, almost like a U team player. And so it was a big call, isn't it?
Mm.
And I think Souness probably would have asked a load of people and gone, what do you think? Because he knew this is a massive big call, you know.
Talking about players and spotting players, how do you look back on your management time?
I enjoyed it. And I think with what I had in terms of the tools and expectations, I think we did well. Spotting players, you spot players and very rarely can you get the players.
Yeah.
You see good players and you go, this is who I want, isn't it? What I always managed to do, and I think that is only natural, my biggest successes were always midfield players. It was always finding midfield players and nobody quite saw what I saw in him, but that was also because maybe I played in a slightly different way, isn't it? I was always very keen on having three centre midfield players. So I did well. I enjoyed it, but it was mission impossible. I took a job too early as a 32-year-old player manager for Swansea, the youngest manager in the country. And although we had some relative success and playoff final at Wembley and whatever, I always felt that the route back to where you wanted to be was too long. It needed you to do well at two or three clubs at that level. And that's very, very difficult. So after the sort of period from 96 to 2004, I decided that I didn't want to do it anymore. I walked away from second spell at Kidderminster, never to manage again, and that was my decision. There's too many things out of your control. There's too many things you're relying on, and that was not what I wanted.
We're lucky to have you on the telly now, and Danish TV are lucky to have you as well. The one thing I've always thought about you is I just wonder whether he's maybe lost to the game in terms of a scouting position, a European scout. He knows a player, Jan Molby, doesn't he?
I've always, it's the one role that intrigues me, working for a football club, and they go, we want a right back. And then you go, what type of right back is it that you want? And then you give yourself 12 or 18 months to find that player. I would love that, because I think that's a real challenge there. You know, I think spotting players is very difficult. I think you can go and watch a game of football and we can almost all agree on who is the best player on the day. But the best player on the day might not be the one you want. The one player you want is the one with the most potential, isn't it? And trying to spot that, I think, is very difficult. And I have this thing about players that almost within 2 minutes you go, yes or no. And people go, that's a bit cruel, that's a bit quick. I said, yeah, but there's either something you like or you don't like. And it doesn't take a lot and you go, yeah, I like him. What I'm saying is that you look at a player for and you see something and you go, he remains on my shortlist or he goes off the shortlist. I didn't fully understand it and you have to watch him again because then you watch more layers of what he's capable or not capable of, isn't it? But that initial, do I like him or don't I like him? And then decide whether you want to pursue watching him. I've always been fascinated with that. I think people who do that job, and there is, it's a bit like players, a bit like managers, isn't it? There is top scouts in the game, there you go. You know, they know what they're looking at.
So if you're a top player now, just be careful about the way you walk from the bus in front of Jan Molby.
Exactly, yeah.
Because he'll be able to make his mind up solely on that.
I'm not sure whether you need to be in either training or playing kit. I don't think it's in playing clothes, is it, Robbie? I think we need them in the kit.
There's a little bit of falseness in your jeans.
Yeah. So maybe in a suit you couldn't tell.
No, I'm not 100% sure. Not in a suit, no. But put them in a football kit. Yeah. We'll be all right.
I'll tell you. last question. How would you like to be remembered by Liverpool fans?
Yeah, it's a good question, that. I mean, I guess a lot of players say, I just want to be remembered as somebody who gave everything. I don't think anyone's ever come up to me and gone, you know, thankful we did for Liverpool, you always gave us everything. Because I don't think that's something that you necessarily associate me with because of the way that I played. So I almost think that I want people to remember me for being somebody who came from afar, that was part of enhancing the way that Liverpool wanted to play. And I think that's almost, I would be happy with people just going, you came and you brought something that we maybe hadn't had before. I'm not greedy in terms of that, you know what I mean? I don't want people to remember me as the best player ever or this and that. I just think that I'm quite happy with people can go that came into what was already a very successful setup, but maybe became part of slightly taking the next step. But that also had something to do with the club's choice of manager, because when Kenny became the manager, great student of the game, it certainly suited what I wanted to do, isn't it? And it's very difficult to put into word, is that what is it that we did or what did we wanted to achieve, isn't it? But it suited me, I know that, because I became more influential, isn't it? So I think without being greedy, I'd be quite happy if people just go, do you know what, he came from a different background, different type of football, gave us what he had, we enjoyed it, and he was part of making us maybe play just in a slightly different way, isn't it?
We love that bit. And we love spending time with you, Jan. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Pleasure. It's been wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to today's show. And if you're listening on Apple and enjoyed it, please leave a comment and feel free to leave us a 5-star rating to help others find our shows. We will be back with another series of We Are Liverpool soon. In the meantime, a massive thank you from all of us on the team here for your follows and your comments. Let us know who you'd like to hear from next time and we will do our level best. Remember, you can catch up with all of the shows wherever you get your podcasts on LFC TV Go, and our official YouTube channel is there for you as well. Until next time, be lucky. We'll see or speak to you soon.